What does Wells Fargo mean to you now that the longtime CEO is out? From Marketplace, I'm David Brancaccio. There's news that the chairman and chief executive of Wells Fargo, John Stumpf, is leaving under a cloud. His undoing was a court case, then a scandal over employees who opened accounts without the customer's permission to meet sales goals. More than 5,000 employees were fired, and Wells Fargo agreed to pay $185 million to settle this. But what about the Wells Fargo brand? Michael Youssim is a professor of management and director of the Leadership Center at the Wharton School.
Since the bank's reputation is really the foundation of why it makes money, that's what creates value. It's not the transaction or the interest you're paying on a loan. While tactically, yes, that's where the money comes into the bank, but strategically, it's the bank's reputation for financial propriety that leads people like you and lots of the listeners here to put their money in an ATM or in a branch office.
That said, a brand like Wells Fargo may be tougher than you think. Here's James Fisher, a professor of marketing at the John Cook School of Business at St. Louis University.
This is part of the reason that brands are so powerful or so valuable as assets. They are able to withstand bad news, and sometimes very bad news. I'm old enough to remember the Tylenol tampering, and while that was not laid at the feet of the firm or its leadership, there were many who thought because it was so bad, the poisonings related with Tylenol, that would be the end of that brand. It wasn't. The brand came back, and it came back very strongly.
Wells Fargo Chief Operating Officer Tim Sloan now gets the top spot at the bank after the Los Angeles Times did an investigative report about Wells Fargo employees opening bogus accounts. Sloan was quoted by the paper back in 2013 saying he was not aware of any overbearing sales culture. In early trading this morning, the Dow Jones Industrial Average was down about 1%, with the S&P 500 close behind. This after weak export data from China. Here's our Thursday analyst, economist Diane Swank, president of DS Economics in Chicago.
What we're looking at is, once again, fears that China is faltering, and this is something through their trade data that is of concern because not only is China a major trading partner for the rest of the world and has spillover effects that we've already seen in our markets, it also is a big issue post-election. One of the things that I'm hearing from both former Bush and current Obama administration officials and people who've served around the world is the biggest challenges to the next presidency will be not only the economic environment that persists, but also a challenge on leadership from China, Russia, and then most importantly, what will happen to inflation in the U.S. in what could be a stagnating economy.
Diane Swank. Now, you need the medicine, and who doesn't like a deal? There's a new paper in the New England Journal of Medicine today that finds coupons for prescription drugs can boost sales by 60%. From the Marketplace Health Desk at WHYY, Dan Gorenstein reports.
Harvard Business School economist Limor Daphne and her team looked at what happened when drug makers issued coupons right before a generic competitor entered the market. By dispensing coupons, Daphne says consumers stuck with the more expensive branded drug rather than switch.
This will draw attention to copay coupons, which are very likely masquerading as benefits for consumers when they're benefits for manufacturers.
Keeping customers on the branded drug meant as much as $2.7 billion in profits for the companies in just the paper's narrow sample. This research may encourage states to follow Medicare, Medicaid, and Massachusetts and ban these coupons. But Adam Fine with Pembroke Consulting says understanding who benefits from coupons is trickier than it seems.
Insurers are pushing more and more cost onto the consumer, and the coupons are a way to offset those costs that your employer has shifted to you.
This paper helps spell out a tension between the potential financial benefits for patients and the long-term spending problems created by coupons. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
Now to the Marketplace for Fine Art. This month, the auction house Sotheby's revealed that a painting sold for about $11 million and supposedly the work of 17th century Dutch artist Frans Hals was a fake. This has called into question other paintings that came from the same source. From time to time, Blake Gopnik comes around to help us with these stories. He's critic at large for ArtNet News and a contributor to the New York Times. And he's been thinking about professional connoisseurs who try to tell real from fake. Blake, good to see you.
Great to be back.
If the best sets of eyes on the planet can't figure it out, to what extent does it matter?
Well, that's a good question. I was thinking about this and I realized all of a sudden that forgeries in finance, say, are totally different than forgeries in art. In finance, you forge a check to change the world, put money in your account. You forge a deed to pretend to own land you don't. In art, when you make a forgery, you want it to meld in. You want it to not change the world in a sense. You don't want a forgery that makes everyone suddenly think, wow, Rembrandt made pornography or Vermeer did an abstraction one day. You want your forgeries to be exactly the same as pictures we already know, which means they don't really change the world. There's almost never a case where you discover a picture's a forgery and the art historians say, oh no, now we have to change everything we thought about Frans Hals.
But as an object that stores value, one of these pictures that is either actually the famous artist or a forgery, that does make a difference.
Yeah, just in the way a $100 bill that's real or fake makes a difference, right? Once you discover that it's not real currency, it's not worth anything anymore. But it just goes to show that the marketplace and real artistic values are completely severed. They have almost nothing to do with each other, except for the weird fact that the value of works of art depends entirely on art history. The reason a Rembrandt is worth a lot is because art historians have said that's an important artist. And those things are always changing. So there's this weird relationship between art history and the market that's like nothing else I've ever come across.
And you see a weird blessing in disguise when these forgeries turn up in terms of prices for fine art?
I like the idea that the marketplace is hurting. The marketplace distorts values. Here we are talking about Frans Hals not because we want to rethink what we think about Frans Hals, what he was as a painter, but just because a $10 million picture is now worth, say, $10,000. And the marketplace itself makes us, in a sense, not talk about real art and makes us talk about fake issues.
Blake Gopnik contributes to the New York Times, ArtNet News, and he's working on his comprehensive biography of Andy Warhol. Blake, thank you.
Thank you.
And in New York, I'm David Brancaccio with the Marketplace Midday Update from APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.